Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Thursday, June 12th, 2014. It's about 2:15 UTC. I'm Sam Minter, and Yvonne Bo is not here yet again. He was expecting to be back this week, but he let me know that his house is still a mess. There's still stuff going on. Plus, he's traveling. I think he's in Texas this week. And so he just wasn't able to do it again. So I reached out to get another co-host. And this time, finally, John, like, you know, when I first added that, well, actually, even before, like, going back years, you've indicated willingness to be on the show sometime, but it seems like every time I've ever put out the call and said, hey, we need a co-host, you're never available. But this week you were available.
This week I am.
So thank you very much for joining us. And we're going to have, we're going to talk about the obvious things. We're going to talk about the whole upset with Eric Cantor losing his primary race and all of the associated implications to the Republican Party, 2014, 2016, everything. Unlike Bruce, who was with us last week, John is an Apple guy. So we will be talking about some of the WWDC Apple stuff that came out a couple weeks ago and some other Apple things. Maybe we'll get into a few other topics, but those will probably carry us for most of the show. Before we started, John and I were just catching up because John worked it with me at a previous job. What is it now? Is it like 10 years, 12 years ago now since we last worked together?
Oh, got it. Yeah, it seems like forever.
Yeah, so it's been a long time. So we were catching up a little bit on how our families were doing and stuff like that. I just wanted to say, give a little bit. We are actually starting recording this about 15 minutes later than I had intended, because right before the show, when I was, I was going and telling my wife that, okay, I'm going up now, make sure, go inside and, deal with my son, Alex, blah, blah, blah. And we were in the front driveway talking, and, Alex came out and was there for a second, and we were talking and we were putting away some stuff. She had been power washing the side of the house and having a blast power washing stuff. And so we were putting that stuff away. And then I'm like, where's Alex? And she's like, did he go in? I'm like, I don't think he went in. So of course we started this, I ran into the house and started looking. She started, and blah, blah, blah. We quickly determined he was not in the house. And so then I'm like, okay. So I head out to the driveway to the street. I look both ways. I don't see him. We go back. We look in the house again. I go back in. No kid anywhere. And so then I'm like, okay, you have to stay in the house. I'm gonna go down the street that way and see if he went that way. And I went.
So Sam, yes. Like, before you finish, I mean, I gotta say, like, this is kind of a throwback thing, because everyone that's like our age,
yep,
like when we were kids, I mean, we all got lost.
Right.
I mean, hell, I think I was gone for like half a day once, and like, they were, a little agitated, my parents, but I don't think like, it wasn't that big a deal. Right. Like, I don't think there's anyone that's like, over the age of 40 that doesn't have a memory of getting lost at like in a department store or something like that. And like nowadays, like, kids gone for like a minute and there's like there are Amber Alerts and, everything's going
and,
on.
And,
so.
And, part of what I was going to ask here is, of course, I have a 19-year-old as well, but she was 7 when I acquired her, as it were, 7 or 8 when I acquired her. But, you've got kids who've gone through this age. So I'd be interested in your take when we get to that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like, now I remember a number of situations where I was a little bit older. He's 4 right now. And I don't remember exactly what I was doing running away or whatever when I was 4. But I remember a number of cases when I was more the 7, 8-ish range, where, one time and some of these I remember directly, some of it I remember the story of being told it, but, where, I decided I was going to walk to where my parents worked, you know, and it, which was a couple miles away somewhere, you know, further than I'd ever gone before. And, you know, and they couldn't find me. And, you know, eventually they did. And another time, you know, I decided instead of catching the school bus home, I'd walk home, and I stopped at the Science Museum for an hour. You know, and so I didn't show up at home when I was supposed to. So, yeah. And you know, I know my parents were worried in those two situations, but you're right. It's the environment is very different. And just the, you know, like the I remember my entire, you know, preteen, you know, single digit years, or at least the part I can remember from like age 5 to 9 or so, you know, just, okay, go out and play.
Oh, yeah.
And you'd like run around the whole, basically there was a single block area. I was allowed to go anywhere on the block, basically. If I was going to go beyond there, it was a bigger deal. But, you know, I would go to the local playground and play with my friends and run around the neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that was sort of expected. And that you're right, that's very rare these days.
Now do kids still climb trees? Because I mean, like, we used to climb trees, and like now I just think, like, if you know, I think kids, what do you sign your kid up for, tree climbing class? Or
probably and then you have to have all the safety harnesses and stuff.
Well that's the thing. I'm just, it's one of those things where, like, to me, like, there's nothing like more like American than, you know, just
climbing trees.
A kid climbing a tree. But the thing is, you know, I gotta think that you know, if your kid actually fell out of a tree and got hurt, like, and you took him to the ER, that you'd have like all kinds of questions to answer. And like,
why,
like,
were you letting them climb the tree?
Yes. No helmet, you know, like, so.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, also the thing I notice, and I mean, this is going to vary rapidly, very dramatically based on where you are. But I look around our neighborhood here. And there are pretty much no trees you could climb even if you want to. There's not the right kind of tree for climbing in our particular neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, because it's not that new a neighborhood, but it's new enough that, like, the trees that are just on the street are way too small to consider doing that. And also they're just, you know, it's the wrong shape and size of tree. Like, I remember when I was a kid, you know, and at that age, like the 5 to 9 age, I was living in North Carolina, and all over the neighborhood, there were trees that were of appropriate size and shape to climb in. And my dad had built a tree house in the one directly in our backyard, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, a fairly rudimentary one, but, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah. So,
well, first of all, is Alex safe?
Alex, are you safe? Will you say anything to John? Are you safe? No?
So, yes? did he go anywhere cool?
So, Alex, do you want to say where you went?
Wow.
No, he's not going to say. Okay. Anyway, yes, he's safe. The bottom line is I headed off one direction where we often walk, and out towards the sort of the biggest street that's nearby, because that was the direction I was most worried about him going by himself. And then when I didn't see him that way, I went the other way, and fairly rapidly I saw him, and he was sitting by the side of the sidewalk, you know, gathering leaves and sticks to give his mother and sister. And and he was absolutely fine, but he'd, you know,
wow.
Yes, Alex, but he'd gone for a walk by himself and so he was where we didn't know where he was for probably about 20 minutes. And I was fairly sure he'd just gone on a walk and would be somewhere along the route we usually walk the dog, which he was, you know, but my wife was in a complete panic because I left her at home while I went looking because you know, in case he came home, somebody needed to be there.
Right.
And so, you know, she was completely, you know, mind spinning in all the worst possible directions in terms of what might have happened. Anyway, I fully suspect that, you know, he's 4 now. Similar things are going to happen, you know, as he gets older and older.
Oh, sure.
You know, because it's just part of doing things. What are your experiences? What's happened? You know, as what are your paternal experiences, you know, along this line?
neither of my kids really like got lost a whole lot. Although, you know, I think, you know, there was some woman that wrote a book or an article or something, you know, and about like sort of quote free range kids.
Yeah,
you know?
she's got a blog that I regularly read as well.
Yeah, and I think there was like she got a lot of backlash about it, you know. And
well, and if I remember right, where she sort of burst into the national spotlight was maybe it's not directly so it's freerangekids.com, and she's also at freerangekids on Twitter. But the first time I remember hearing about it, and it may have just been associated with the movement or whatever, but was the woman in New York City who let her, I don't know, it was 7 or 8 year old, go somewhere on the subway by themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and like, I guess like I've sort of had a similar reaction. I mean, like, I think there was when Ben was maybe like 12 or 13, I mean, we let him like take the DC Metro somewhere by himself.
Right.
You know, and like, I think when he got on, he got on going the wrong direction, but he figured it out. He got off, got back on, like, you know, it was all good, you know? So, you know, I think sometimes like, you know, that is how you learn. And I do think that like, you know, the hysteria over the whole thing is probably like, you know, overblown. I mean, I mean, not suggesting that you shouldn't be like a little bit prudent about it, but like, you know, I do think sometimes people get a little overly paranoid about the safety thing.
Yeah. Look, one of the most dramatic things I remember seeing along those lines was a few years ago. Now there was an article somewhere where somebody it was in England somewhere, but somebody whose family had lived in the same house for like something like 3 or 4 generations, you know, and she was now a journalist or whatever, and she interviewed her parents and her grandparents as far back as she could get, and about basically how far from the house were they allowed to go when they were children, and made a map. And it showed, you know, the grandfather or whatever, you know, basically had free roam in like a 10 mile radius around the house or something huge like that. And then it was much, much smaller for the parents. And the current generation was, you know, basically can't leave the house without a parent, you know.
Wow.
And it, with each generation it becoming smaller. And I think that, you know, there is, you can make arguments that say, well, it's a more dangerous world, blah, blah, blah. But actually, the facts don't back that up. You know, if you look at crime statistics or anything else like that, they're the lowest they've ever been.
Yeah, I know. I just think it's like, you know, it's the news media and the, you know, and I guess, I don't know if social media is making it worse or, but I do think, people, I think it's just overblown.
I mean, bottom line, bad things always happen, but they are, you know, unusual things. That's why you hear about them, is because, right, you know, for the most part, you know.
Yeah, and I think some of it's sort of a, I don't know, it's like a suburban thing, mm-hmm, too. I mean, like think about this for a second. I mean, there are kids that go to school in the city, and they take city public transportation to get to school. Like, that's how they get there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they get on trains and buses and everything like that, and they somehow get to school. And yet, like, out in the suburbs, I marvel. Like, if you go past the high school in my town, like, there's a 15-mile-an-hour school zone around the high school. Like, you know what? Like, if you're, like, you know, 17 and going to high school, I'd like to think that, you know, that you're as smart as the kid that lives in the city and that you can look both ways before you cross the street. I mean, do we really need to like slow the traffic down to 15 miles an hour? I don't know.
Yeah. I think the pendulum has definitely swung to be, little bit more paranoid than it perhaps needs to be. I mean, you see this all, but you see this argument on all safety things, actually. It's like, okay, yeah, you're right. It's not really that dangerous. And maybe we're talking about one in a million occurrences, but if with a few minor things, you can avoid that one in a million occurrence, why not? But, you know, the other thing I saw recently, and I, you know, since I'm speaking off the cuff, I don't have any articles about this, but there was an experiment done, I think it was in New Zealand, where they looked at specifically playgrounds at schools. And activities there, like just like everything else we've talked about, they're much more regimented. You don't just have, you know, recess where you let the kids go out and play and don't do whatever. You have all kinds of rules about what they can play, what they can't play. They have people watching out, and if somebody calls somebody a name or pushes somebody or whatever, there's immediate discipline and blah blah blah. And what they did was basically say, okay, screw it, no rules. You know, the teachers and parents are going to back off, and the kids are just going to go out to play for an hour. And what they actually found was that there were less injuries. The kids were getting hurt less often. The kids were getting more and better exercise. They were coming in more invigorated, and they were better able to the performance in the classes immediately after was improved. As compared to the sort of regimented, you know, the highly organized, you know, PE class or whatever.
Right. Well, you know what? On the same lines, and like, I know I get strong disagreement on this point from like everyone. So
okay.
I'm gonna say something that like. That no one is going to agree with me on here. So,
okay.
But I think it's the same thing is true with bicycle helmets. Okay. Mm. Now, I'm not suggesting that bicycle helmets are a terrible idea. I myself, if I'm going out for the most part, given the choice, I will wear a bicycle helmet. However, we went to, to Europe a couple of summers ago, and you know, we went to Amsterdam and a lot of other cities where they were like, you know, there was just like everyone rides bicycles,
mm-hmm.
and like nobody wears a damn helmet. Like, and I haven't seen like lots of statistics or whatever.
You know,
and
I'll give you what I think is the big difference there, though. Because I've seen some of these about Europeans as well in terms of this. And one of the differences, the bicycles are so common and so expected and so ingrained into the culture that the motorists expect them and are aware of them and are much more deferential to the bicycles compared to the U.S.
Yeah, and they have their own lanes and stuff like that. But I just think it's like, you know, they're... You know, you can bicycling is, it's like a form of transportation, and you see old ladies on bikes and, you know, whole families like loaded onto one bike, you know, riding around. And like nobody's going particularly fast. I mean, here, you know, it's like you can't go out on a bicycle unless you first like, you know, put on layers of like lycra clothing and you know, and special shoes and you know, and you suit up and you go out for a ride just for exercise. And, you know, I just think it's a shame because I think that's part of the reason why
it doesn't take off as much.
It doesn't take off is because we've made it so expensive and so complicated and so cumbersome that nobody ever rides a damn bike.
Well, and I could see like, you know, because, you know, when I was, you know, pre 10 years old, you know, the helmet wasn't part of the bicycle experience either. And, you know, although I wear them today, like if I go on my bike right now, I do wear it. But I think for the most part, like the riding around your bike in your neighborhood in a fairly controlled space, I mean, that's not where the helmet makes a big difference. The helmet makes, although there certainly are accidents that can happen in that scenario where the helmet helps. It really is the, you know, if you're in an environment where there are cars and other stuff going on and you're on busier streets where it really makes a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to go out...
And again, the difference in Europe is, you know, the cars fundamentally behave differently because the bikes are so common. Whereas here, they're still sort of like, you know, it differs by cities. But for the most part, the cars aren't in the mind of really having to pay attention to that. You're paying attention to other cars.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, I mean, we live in a small town. And if I'm, you know, if I'm going to, like, get on a bike and ride a couple blocks over to the center of town to, like, the farmer's market or something like that, I mean, like, and I'm going to be riding at a pace that's not that much faster than I could run, like, I'm not suggesting that I wouldn't be safer with a helmet. I'm just saying that, like, you know, that the risk is pretty low, you know, and but it's gotten to the point where, honestly, it's like, if you ride a bike without a helmet, it's almost like you're socially shunned. I mean, yeah. it's almost like a pregnant lady with a cigarette. I mean, it's people are like, what the hell is he doing? You know, and like, it's a little ridiculous.
And I think the one bit that, you know, you bring up is often in these safety discussions, the cost part of the cost benefit is never fully calculated, or you're put in a saves one life, you know, kind of argument. But really, you do have to look at the cost benefit, and you do have to, and okay, how do you measure that? Blah blah blah. But you know, if you are giving up a significant and moving back from the bicycle helmet just to like how far kids can roam and things like that. Okay, yeah, maybe you are making your kids a little bit marginally safer in terms of some things, but at the same time, are you denying them the experience that's necessary to get to a higher level of self-sufficiency and confidence or whatever? There's a real trade-off there in all of these things. And I think we probably have gone too far in some areas. I mean, I'm all for safety features when they are essentially free, where, you know, you do something that's very little additional cost and you get some marginal safety from it. Okay, whatever. But you do have to be careful about those, because it's just like the, you know, not to veer off into a complete tangent, but it's also the same, you know, freedom versus security thing that's played out on a large scale with national security issues. You know, there is a trade-off. You can't be perfectly safe ever. Everything you do to protect yourself to become safer comes at a cost. And you have to be cognizant of, okay, maybe I'm a little bit safer, but what am I giving up for that? And am I actually okay with that?
Yeah, no, I agree, you know. And, you know, it's funny how it's like the same, you know, the same parent that will sort of look at you funny if your kid's not wearing a bicycle helmet, like, will gladly sign their kid up for, you know, youth football, you know, where their kids' heads getting pounded every day, you know? So,
yeah, well, you know, for me, I'm going to insist on the helmet, and I'm not letting them play football either.
Well, there you go. I guess you haven't hit the youth sports thing yet. So,
well, we tried last summer. We enrolled him in, like, you know, 3-4 year old soccer. He absolutely hated it, wanted nothing to do with it, resisted at every turn. So we're not trying again this summer. Maybe again at some point, like if he expresses interest at some point, but you know, I don't want to project too much of myself, but I remember, you know, when I was made to do various youth sports things when I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, I really did not like it. And I was out of it as soon as I could manage to get out of it. It just wasn't something that I was interested in. And I see much the same kind of thing in him. But, you know, he's 4. That might be completely different by the time he's 6 or 7.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree.
So,
I mean, look, your job as a parent is just to give him a lot of opportunities to try stuff. So,
yeah. I mean, and the way I look at all of these stuff is I want to give as much opportunity as I can, but I don't want to push. I don't want to force him into directions that he doesn't really want to go in. And at the same time, I want to encourage his interest. If he shows, you know, a whole lot of interest in Area A, which in Alex's case has been trains for the last 2 years, then great. You know, learn everything you can about trains. Do play all the train games. Do this, do that. Go visit train museums. Awesome. Follow your interest there. And yeah, I mean, I guess at some point there's an issue of like, do you want somebody to be, you know, entirely single-minded? No. And so you expose them to all kinds of other things. But I don't think for the most part you need to, as a parent, actively shape that stuff. You just provide lots of opportunities and let them go in the areas they're interested in.
Absolutely.
So let's take a break. And we'll come back and talk about Eric Cantor.
All right.
Back after this. Okay, we're back. So John, do you want to give a as I throw things on my desk, give the quick like 2 minute summary of what the hell happened, and then we'll talk about it.
Well, you know, as I understand it, Eric Cantor, who is the, I guess, the majority leader in the House, and I guess was considered to be a possible future Speaker of the House, lost his primary race to an economics professor. It was like a complete upset. And so now you've got the, and in fact, I think today he just resigned or said he was going to resign his leadership post because I guess he's sort of a lame duck. And actually, you know, I was interested in getting your thoughts on, like, what the hell happened? Because I know you follow the polling.
So here's the thing. And this is actually points out a very interesting blind spot to all of the data-driven analysis that's out there, is that, frankly, the main reason here is everybody was so convinced that there was a shoe-in, that this was a shoe-in, that there was essentially no polling out there. There was one internal poll by the Cantor folks that showed him up like 30 some points, some crazy thing. And then there was some another poll by a polling outfit that doesn't have all that great a history, good history for accuracy, that showed him up like 15 points, but it was, you know, a few weeks old. And so there was very little polling to begin with, because A, nobody was all that interested in this race because they didn't think it would be close to begin with. So nobody bothered polling it. Second, the ones that were done were not of great quality. Third, with these kind of primaries, it's incredibly hard to poll them anyway, because unlike presidential races or Senate races, House districts are pretty small. The turnout for primaries in House districts is even smaller. And when you add to this, in this particular case, nobody expected it to be a real race, so turnout was even smaller. So what you have is a situation where, I believe the stats were something like, the number of people who voted against Eric Cantor were about 5% of his constituents to cause this loss. So it tells you that, you know, only about 10% of the population in his district bothered to vote in the Republican primary at all, which is, you know, okay, if you think about it, it's a heavily Republican district. Let's say Republicans were 70, even 80%. Typical turnout, even at a presidential election, doesn't get above 60%. So now we're already down at a small... So yeah, it's just tiny numbers here. We're talking a few tens of thousands of people. And so if you have a situation where, you know, all the people who are for him think he's a shoo-in, so why bother coming to the polls? Whereas a dedicated number of people who are against him, if they can do the get out the vote thing, then guess what? They win. And so I think, you know, one of the things it teaches in terms of this is that, one, it's probably worth polling more races than people think are. I mean, you're probably not going to have the budget to be polling all House races every time, every primary, every general, every whatever. However, certainly for, like, you know, the top 10 or 20 leadership positions, it's probably worth doing a few polls just to read the temperature. But even then, it is very, very hard to get an accurate pulse on these kinds of things because of all the turnout dynamics here and because of, you know, so few people end up being here. So I think that's a big part of why it was a surprise. There's some indications that there may have been a turn just in the last few weeks, which makes it even harder to catch these things. Like, it may well have been that a month ago he was going to cruise to a win, but then he said a few things over the last few weeks that pissed people off and it made the difference. But you have, you know, the other aspect of this is you have wildly conflicting after the fact people trying to explain, well, why'd he lose? And of course, the jokesters are like, well, he lost because he got less votes. But when you're trying to actually get beyond that to, well, okay, but what were the issues? What, you know, so there are a lot of people talking about the immigration thing, but there's not a lot of evidence behind that. It's not like they had exit polls for this either. So they're not people walking out saying, well, why did you vote the way you did? There are people talking about it being an open primary and Democrats coming in and voting and trying to screw things up. And there was some mathematical analysis of that that says there was almost undoubtedly some of that going on, but not enough to make a difference given how big the margins were. There are people talking that it's just he got sort of all into his leadership position and forgot to, like, pay attention to his own district. And so he wasn't doing a good job on constituent service or anything like that. And even, like, you know, did he actually bother campaigning and knocking on people's doors and asking for their vote? Or was he all too busy being leadership and just wasn't paying attention? And, you know, bottom line is, I think people are going to make up all kinds of stories about this, but nobody knows and nobody's going to know. Because we didn't have sort of the instrumentation on this race to get that information. We didn't have the polling. We didn't have exit polls. It's too small numbers, you know. And so, is it the fact that the right wing radio hosts were pounding on this and trying to drum up his opponents? Was it the immigration thing? Was it the Democrats? Was it this? Was it that? You know, I think, you know, all of the above. To some degree, but, you know, I don't know that it's any one of those in particular either. I think, frankly, a lot of it is just, you know, the weird dynamics of a small race, and you know, with turnout numbers that small, you know, all kinds of things can happen, and I think that also flips to the, well, let's talk about the greater narrative of, you know, a few weeks ago, everybody was talking about how the Tea Party was dead, that all the, and this includes me and Yvonne on this show, how, you know, it seemed like all of the incumbents were winning and the establishment types were winning and fending off all the Tea Party challengers, and that the sort of voters had decided to some degree to vote for the people who know how to win the general election, as opposed to the people who are more ideologically pure or whatnot. And this is a counterexample, and it certainly is an earthquake, and there's all kinds of implications for this in terms of national politics. But I think in terms of the race itself, I don't know. Like, if you went back and reran the election now and said, okay, everybody vote again, you'd probably have a much higher turnout and maybe you'd have a different result. But of course, that's not how things work. So I don't know what the national, you know, the full implications here are. I mean, this is a solid Republican district. The Democrats weren't even going to run somebody against him. The guy who's the Democratic candidate jumped in and declared his candidacy, you know, within 24 hours of the primary. You know, like, he wasn't even a candidate 48 hours ago, you know, and he's also an unknown from the same university, but almost certainly has no chance given the makeup of this district, unless this untested guy who just won ends up making major gaffes of some sort, which that's been the risk in the past of these type of candidates, is that, you know, they're just untested on a larger scale and end up shooting themselves in the foot. But
gotcha.
But we'll see. Absent something like this, you know, the Republican game, what's his name? Best Rust. I'm blanking on the guy's name, the guy who won.
Oh, Brat?
Brat. That's what it was. I knew it was four letters. Yeah, I mean, unless he screws something up majorly, he'll win just because this this particular district is a very, very, very Republican district.
See, and I, you know, like, if you listen to him, I mean, I will say that, you know, for one of the Tea Party folks, I mean, he seemed like he came off as more reasonable and less crazy than some. So,
I actually haven't listened to any of his interviews yet. The one thing I've read is, like, on a couple of his interviews after this, where people started asking about him about issues, he was basically unprepared to really talk about issues. He was like, I thought we were just going to talk about, like, the celebration. You know, and so, I mean, he's got time to ramp up. But I think, you know, if anything, he was prepared on the intra-Republican issues. He wasn't, like, set up to talk about, the kinds of things that come up in a general election.
I mean, really, all he has is, like, and maybe this, there's something to be learned from this, but, you know, is basically he just sort of hits the four or five, like, you know, key Tea Party points, you know, and you know, and hits them hard. So, I mean, and you know what? I mean, I guess, you know, that's my concern with the Tea Party is, like, you know, look, it's great to be, to have, you know, values and objectives and all those things. But at the end of the day, we have a democratic process and you have to be able to govern. I mean, that's why they're there. And, you know, just going and saying no to everything, like there's no way that they're going to have, you know, an absolute majority to do what they want. So, I mean, if they're never going to compromise on anything, then what's, you know, how's the process supposed to move forward?
Yeah, and that's one of the fundamental patterns that's emerged here is, you know, the ideologically pure, this is what we believe, that's it, we're no compromises ever. Compromise is evil. If you compromise, you're a rhino. And that's part of what they were saying about Cantor is, like, you know, he actually was willing to work with the Democrats on some things. Traitor.
Right.
You know, and
Well, so, I mean, and that sort of gets into, like, the whole question of, like, what does this mean? And, like, where is the Republican Party headed? And, you know, and let me just say, like, you know, I'm registered as a Republican. I always have been. And, you know, I'm probably more on the libertarian side of things, you know, but, you know, it. But basically, I'm sort of a moderate, and, like, So I have a very long commute. I work in near Scranton, Pennsylvania. And so, you know, I spend lots of time in the car, and some of my drive, I end up listening to right wing talk radio. Like, and it's like the, you know, the most outrageous of the, I mean, it's all like Mark Levin and Sean Hannity and, you know, and Glenn Beck. And let me just say, like, these people, and the local guy in the morning, this morning, was just giddy. I mean, he was just giddy. I mean, like, they're so excited about this guy and about what this means for everything. And it all goes down to, you know, after after Romney lost, like the lesson to be learned as far as most of those folks were concerned was that they needed to double down, like that they weren't, you know, Romney wasn't conservative enough, you know, and that he didn't, you know, hit the values hard enough, you know, and that's why he lost. And so they think that this is just a sign that that if you just go and you're pure enough and, you know, and nutty enough that you can, you know, that people will, you know, somehow the message will resonate with people. And that's the key to the Republicans winning and taking the country back. And I just don't think that's right. I mean, like, and I as a Republican, I just wish that the Republicans would just drop, like, a number of like their current, like, you know, issues and narratives and move on. I mean, it's so.
I think, you know, we're going through that phase where, I mean, I've said this before, like, to some degree, you have to have the old guard die off before you can have that renaissance. 'Cause I think there are, you know, I've said before, I've got a lot of sympathies towards the libertarian side of things as well. I'm not a purist on that front. There are lots of government things I think are just fine. But I have that tendency. But I look at, you know, the vast majority of what I see in the Republican Party, and I'm like, I can't go there. You know, it's just
well, right. I mean, and this guy, you know, look, I heard his like speech after he won, and, you know, and he talked about, you know, about, you know, smaller government and mm-hmm. rule of law and lower taxes.
You're like,
and
that sounds, you know, great.
Yeah, that sounds good. But then, like, of course, his final thing that he summed it up was, you know, was embracing and reinforcing Judeo-Christian values that made this country so great. And again, like, look, I go to church. Like, I have no problem with like people, like, you know, worshiping however they want and religion and all that kind of stuff. I'm fine with it, but I don't think that being fine with it means that I need to mix it with my politics, you know? And so I just, you know, I wish the Republicans would just drop the whole, you know, right wing Christian, you know, values, you know, right out of their platform. Well, if they would just.
Yeah. Well, what I've said before is, like, if you look at the trends in this country, the libertarian impulse on civil liberties is a growing constituency. There's a big constituency for sort of, economic prudence, which doesn't necessarily mean the religious no taxes kind of thing, but it means being responsible with money and spending and stuff. It's not necessarily nothing. Yeah, it's not the dramatic stuff, but being responsible fiscally, being good on civil liberties. These are all sort of things that have growing constituencies. The one thing that is not only a shrinking constituency, but actually actively alienates huge parts of the population are religious fundamentalism, the anti-immigrant stances, the anti-gay stances, all of these sort of basically the cultural conservatism,
right,
is the stuff and that is baggage. If the Republican Party could jettison that,
exactly,
they would be very competitive in a lot of areas, including amongst young people, which is that right now, you know, if you look at the demographics in the last few elections, more and more and more, the Republican Party is the party of old white people.
Well, right. And, you know? And so, and like, just as an example, I mean, like, let the Benghazi thing go. I mean, for God's sakes, like, does anyone care about, like, look, and I'm not suggesting that mistakes weren't made,
right,
but mistakes are made in every administration, like mistakes that cost people's lives. I mean, hell, Bush went into Iraq and like, for what? I mean,
and there are all kinds of, you know, when people have sort of stacked up the numbers and looked at, okay, how many diplomatic personnel died under Bush's watch versus Clinton's watch? Guess what? Bush's watch is like, you know, way above. Same thing, even just with this Bergdahl thing that's happened in the last few weeks. There have been stats on, okay, we released five high-ranking Taliban, and they may go back to the battlefield. Okay, so somebody produced some bar charts of how many Taliban we released during the Bush administration, including how many went back to the battlefield verified. And there are tons of them, you know, and it's just, and this is another thing that always gets me, is this, the selective memories, and this is absolutely both sides. There's no consistency in terms of this is bad no matter who does it. It's this is bad if the other guy does it. If my guy does it, oh well.
Yeah, I know. The hypocrisy is just ridiculous. Like, look, here's the thing. In my opinion, you know, like, you know, I don't think Ronald Reagan could get elected as a Republican today.
I'm pretty sure he would have trouble.
I mean, and now he's considered like a saint. And, you know, and they put all the, you know, the little, you know, photos and captions on Facebook, and they pass them around, and they take little snippets of things that he said that are consistent with their, you know, with what's going on now. And they, you know, and
ignore
and
everything else.
Right. And they ignore everything else. But the simple fact is, like, he was like a California, like, actor who was part of a union, who was divorced, who like, I mean, like, how many people died in Beirut? And then we pulled out of there.
And, you know, and he raised taxes. And he was a very strong proponent of nuclear disarmament. He wanted to go to a 0-0 situation with the Russians. You know, there were all kinds of things Reagan was doing that, you know, aren't necessarily, you know, in line, but yeah, I don't know. I think, look, the Republican Party, we're going to have fun watching the Republican Civil War play out over the next two and a half years. And we'll see where they end up. I mean, and I think they fundamentally, you know, it's going to be the same as all the other cycles. My prediction is still, and this is only a very slight prediction, they're going to end up with an establishment candidate again, no matter how much the base doesn't like it. And because all the money is going to get behind them, and then, you know, they're going to lose because they're going to be so compromised going through the primary process for 2016 that they don't play well in the general, plus add all the demographic trends. That's one possibility. The other is no establishment candidate really is able to get all of the support, or they decline to run or whatever, and you get one of the factions, either the libertarian faction with Rand Paul, or one of the more religious conservative ones, or one of the more Tea Party-ish ones, or so one of the factions gets their guy in place without having the sort of person that nobody really likes, but they can all sort of agree is okay, like we had with Romney and before him McCain, and then they're going to get crushed. It'll be a Barry Goldwater, Lyndon Johnson kind of thing if they nominate somebody that is far enough out of the mainstream. Because, you know, the bottom line is, to win elections, you need to hit that 50% mark.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't do that by nominating an extremist. And okay, ideological purity, and you know, and I think a large part of the Republican Party would rather have a candidate that is pure ideologically and does everything they want, even if that means they lose.
I think that's true. I mean, like, you know, I mean, at one point, like, I realized, you know, with the, you know, with the White House, you know, it's like, you know, the one party, you know, doesn't want to cooperate with the other because they don't want to give the, you know, the other party an opportunity to, you know, to have something to run on, and they might win the White House. And, you know, it used to be that I thought it was basically, you know, it was all about power, you know, and now I think it's just about hatred. Like they just hate Obama so much, you know, and so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I just don't see, you know, the one guy that I thought that was sort of mainstream who I thought could run well, like, you know, was before the whole bridge thing was Chris Christie.
Uh-huh.
And he was always kind of a loose cannon, you know, that, but, you know, like, you know, he's sort of a plain talking kind of straight shooting guy, you know, and, you know,
and then he goes and shoots himself in the foot a few times.
Yeah, exactly. So I think he's probably pretty much done.
Well, and you know, it may well be that, you know, he was, you know, and again, that's this dynamic of, do you get the establishment guy or do you get the outsider? And he may have been too establishment for the Republican primary process anyway, you know, because, you know, he was all chummy with Obama during Hurricane Sandy and everything like that. And, you know, that would be held against him and blah, blah, blah. Now, having said that, he's not out yet. I mean, there's still some possibilities there, but he's certainly very damaged. But as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, in the very few preliminary polls that are out there already, you know, that I have on my little polling site that I'm working on, if you do head-to-head matches against Clinton, he still does better than anybody else in the field. But can he get through the Republican primary is a whole different question. And in order for that to happen, in order for him to be the establishment candidate that's able to do that, all the money has to get behind him. And I think the money was preparing to get behind him before all this blew up. And now they're hands off.
Right.
And the question is, do they find somebody else, or do they get to the point where they're like, okay, we can get behind him after all. It's going to be a fun old time in the GOP over the next couple years. And, you know, people have pointed out this, nothing really is going to happen in the rest of this Congress leading up to 2014. Not like it was going to happen anyway, to be honest. And that, you know, anybody who was even thinking about, perhaps, you know, doing some bipartisan things is now having second thoughts because of Cantor. Nothing was going to happen anyway, you know, and frankly,
right.
probably nothing's going to, you know, at the best possible conceivable situation for the Democrats right now is to maintain the status quo after 2014. Nobody really thinks they're going to retake the House. Nobody really thinks they're going to retake the Senate. The question is, how much do the Republicans gain and can they flip the Senate? So nothing's going to happen for the following 2 years anyway, plus a lame duck president. You know, in terms of any active policy really happening, at least anything that's beyond what sort of things that are completely uncontroversial, like naming post offices or things that can be done by executive action, nothing is happening until 2017 at the earliest.
Yeah. I think you're right.
So I don't know. I hate feeling like a broken record on this, but I would, you know, I think long term, looking beyond 2016, again, it gets back to people dying off. What's going to happen is the culturally conservative portion of the Republican Party is going to continue diminishing in numbers until at some point. And I'm not yet willing to say it's going to be 2016, but maybe 2020, maybe 2024, The other portions of the Republican Party will be able to sort of take unequivocal control of the Republican Party. And at that point, when you've got when you get to a Republican Party that is a lot more libertarian in character, a watered down libertarianism, not like a purist Ron Paul libertarian, then you'll have a competitive party that can make some arguments. Now, having said that, you know, I say competitive as if it's a done deal that the Democrats are winning in 2016. I think they've got the heavy advantage going into 2016, but it's not a done deal. You always have other external factors besides the kinds of ones we're talking about. Like, you know, we have now, regardless of how anemic the recovery has been in the last 6 years or whatever, we've now had one of the longest periods of recovery since World War II. So we're due for another recession. You know, and if we went into another deeper recession again prior to 2016, that could change everything. If Hillary gets nominated and then makes some really stupid mistakes, you know, that could sink things too. So you've got all kinds of external factors here. You know, we could have another 9/11 style terrorist attack. That could completely change the environment as well. So there are lots of scenarios that you could envision that would still result in Republicans winning in 2016. But if you're just looking at the sort of overall landscape, they've got a really hard uphill battle. As long as they're losing the urban folks, losing minorities, more and more losing women, as long as you've got those tendencies increasing over time, they have a really, really hard time getting to a presidential win, also because of how things are distributed in electoral college and things like that. As we can see, it's a very different picture in Congress, you know? Because it's all organized differently. The dynamics of the races are different. And so we may have a situation where we have Republican Congresses and Democratic presidents for a while. Okay, I think we killed that topic. Let's take another break, and we will come back and talk about, what was it? Oh, Apple. And so, yes. Bruce, who hosted us last week, he doesn't like the Apple stuff. So, you know, you can tune out now, Bruce, because we're going to be talking about Apple for the rest of the show, probably. Anyway, we'll be back after this. Okay, here we are. So, because we haven't had, you know, another Apple guy besides me on the show since WWDC, we haven't talked about it at all. And of course, there are all the usual rumors swirling about Apple hardware products as well. But there was a lot in this year's WWDC. Just to highlight for anybody who's not paying attention, they talked a lot about the next version of macOS, which is Yosemite. They talked a lot about the next version of iOS, iOS 8. And then they talked a lot about new developer features that will enable all sorts of additional functionality on both of those platforms. And also, specifically, they spent a lot of time concentrating on things that make your phone and your iPad and your computer all work together more seamlessly than they have before. I think that was probably the biggest theme out of what was announced.
Well, you know, and of course, the other thing that's happened recently is the Apple stock split.
Yeah.
It split 7-1. So if you're an Apple stockholder,
I personally now have 7 shares because my 1 share split.
Nice.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, the stock at one point was up over 700, and then, you know, Steve Jobs died, and you know, it's been sort of in a tailspin for a while, and it's gone up and down a little, but it's been clawing its way back up. And I think, you know, in part, I think that's because of the dividends that they've been basically giving back some of their cash hoard. Mm-hmm. And they've been, you know, issuing dividends. They've also...
One thing I just want to mention, you mentioned the going up and down. They actually hit their all-time high in 2012, which was a while after Steve Jobs died. You know, it didn't...
Yeah.
It did not start going down when he died. It actually went up considerably after he died. And it's only... it went down from sort of the middle of 2012 to the middle of 2013, and everybody panicked. But it's been heading up again... then since then. So I mean, if you look at like the 5-year history, out of 5 years, it was down for 12 months of that 5 years, and if you look at 10 years, it looks even better than that.
Yeah, so you know, I think that you know, right now I expect it to kind of keep going up a bit, you know, mostly because of the various like rumors and expectations, like that were sort of, you know, started at the conference, and you know, I think most of the iOS stuff people don't really care that much about. You know,
tell me, because a lot of, I mean, I looked at that list of features for both the Mac side and the iOS side. And I kept saying, "Oh yeah, I would use that. Would make that much better.
I was very excited
about these updates."
Oh no! I don't get me wrong. I'm excited about them. Like I think that they'll be, you know, useful, you know, enhancements. But you know, I think that what people care about and what drives the stock price is new hardware.
Okay, so you're talking about it from an investment point of view again. So
yeah, well, a little bit. I mean, and look, I mean, I think you know, you and I were both there.
So I'll tell you before we can go into the rest of that. But like, the thing is, the software I think very much drives the hardware, and specifically, a lot of the changes they're talking about here are things that more tightly connect the ecosystem, which will encourage greater lock-in. And, you know, people, there's, of course, two sides of lock-in. One is, you know, oh my God, it sucks. It means it's really hard to change platforms. On the other hand, it's about making the experience so compelling you don't want to. And certainly from a financial point of view, lock-in is a good thing because it means you've got a lot more... you've got a lot less churn of your user base, because once people get into it, they tend to stay in it. And I think a lot of the features they're talking about are going to make that much more compelling, because if you've got the whole system sort of working together where it's not just your phone, but your phone works with your iPad, works with your computer, and you seamlessly transfer things back and forth. And I think a lot of that is going to help in that area. And of course, there's all the rumors they're going to add a watch or whatever to that as well. So I think, okay, maybe the hardware is what immediately drives the bottom line numbers, but the software, to a large degree, is what makes that hardware compelling.
Oh, no, I agree. I mean, that's clearly, you know, what makes Apple special, like, is the software. You know, I think, like, what I think... you know, is going to get people like really jazzed up is like when they come out with some new piece of hardware, you know.
Especially if we're not just talking, okay, here's the new MacBook, it's a little bit faster, but here's this brand new thing you've never seen before and didn't even know you wanted, but now you're going to drool over it.
Right. I think, hey, look, I think you and I were both there when OS X came out, mm-hmm. It was going on sale, I think, at the King of Prussia Mall. That's like the only place where there was like an Apple store anywhere in the area.
And I waited in line and with you, right?
Right. And we're all in this enormous line of people waiting to get their OS X, you know, and it stretched all the way down the mall. And, you know, and then like, but these girls were like sort of coming out of like, you know, the Limited or whatever, and sort of like coming up and asking like what's going on here, you know, like, and you know, do they have a cool new computer they're selling or something? And I think you were like, no, it's software, it's the operating system. And they were like, software, what? Like, so I think that look, you're absolutely right. I mean, the enhancements to the software are going to be great. And you know, one of the things I think that makes it extra great is because, like, even if you have like a phone that's like you know, a generation behind, you still get the advantage of the software update. So, right. You know, the phone that you have in your pocket now, when they come out with a new update, is going to do a whole bunch of things that maybe it didn't do before.
And the same goes on the computer side. It's a free update, you know, right. As was the last one. It's you don't have to go out and spend $20 or $100 to get the new version of it. It's just, you know, you'll get a notification on your computer saying it's available, and you click it, and boom, there you go. And that's one of the areas where, again, when Apple is compared to other manufacturers, and this is both on the computer side and on the mobile side, you know, the percentage of Apple users who are on the most recent version of everything is much, much higher. It's very high. Whereas if you look at the Windows world or the Android world, it just doesn't work that way. You know, people, the vast majority of people, whatever came on their phone or their computer when they bought it is what stays on it until they get a new computer or phone. And there are exceptions, of course. They're sort of the geeky folks who really care about that, make sure that, you know, they do whatever they need to do in order to upgrade. But if you're just a regular old user, most of the time, they're not on that kind of cycle. Which makes it much harder for software developers, which is why, even though people, you know, are saying from absolute numbers, there are more Android devices out there, for instance, lots of things are still come out first on iOS because it's a more predictable environment. And there have been numerous times where it's shown that the people are more likely to spend their money on stuff on Apple as well. So you get that advantage. So
what are you expecting to see in terms of the like features in the next iPhone, and do you think we're going to see the watch anytime soon? And
you know, you keep hearing about the watch, so I think you keep hearing about the watch, and you keep hearing about the television going on for years now, but they have yet to materialize. I think this is another case. I mean, just like you heard about the tablet for years before the iPad was released. You know, Apple's going to make a tablet. Apple's going to make a tablet. And before that, I guess the phone. But I don't know. I think here's what I think. There will probably be a wearable from Apple before very long. It may well be this year. The rumors are getting more and more specific and now saying something about the fall for something. But I think it's going to be different than, you know, it's not just going to be like all of these Android watches that have come out or the Pebble or things like that are very specifically tied to, you know, okay, this is how you get notifications from your phone without pulling your phone out of the pocket. I don't think that's what Apple's going to do. If they develop a wearable, they're going to have something compelling about it that isn't something you get on your phone anyway. You just don't have to take it out of your pocket. It's going to be something that only actually works in the wearable form factor, and it's going to be something compelling and new. And you've got all of this about the health stuff. I would not be surprised at all if it's got a lot of health tracking stuff built into it as well. But I think there's going to be some there, for Apple to decide to pull the trigger on this, they have to see something that they feel is absolutely compelling as a standalone product. I think it's going to be something that you can potentially use even if you don't have an iPhone or an iPad or a Mac. It has to be something that has independent utility, not just as an add-on to your other devices.
I mean, Apple's pretty savvy about having, you know, that compelling feature. I mean, like a couple of iPhones ago, it was the, it was Siri. And, you know, last time it was the fingerprint unlocking. Right. You know, like there's always something sort of cool about it that it's going to do for you. And, you know, I guess I've seen some speculation about mobile payments that, you know, you'd be able to, you know, just sort of, if you had the watch, you wouldn't have to get your wallet out to pay for stuff. You could just go into the Starbucks or whatever wave.
Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. I mean, they have the passbook thing already on the iPhones. But you've got a major chicken and the egg problem with that kind of thing, because, you know, you're not going to bother with it until it's available lots and lots of places. Like I within the last 6 months started actually using the Starbucks app to pay at Starbucks. And I resisted for a while because I was like, you know, it seems stupid, you know, but okay. I finally got into it and I see the utility, but you have to have sort of a critical mass there so that people don't feel like they're looking stupid when they do it, for one thing, and also that it's actually available at a lot of the places you go. Like, you're not going to buy a watch for a payment feature that's only available at two stores.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. And the health stuff, I mean, I run, like, you know, I'm training for a marathon. Like I think a lot of that would be really cool. And the thing that sort of first made me sort of convinced that they were coming out with a watch pretty soon was the fact that that they actually screwed up a product. Like the iPod Nano, like the smallest iPod that they make.
Yeah.
It is essentially
not the shuffle, but the one that looked like the watch form factor. For a while.
Right. It was like a little postage stamp sized thing with a touch screen. Mm-hmm. And it was basically watch sized and it was wearable.
And people made bands for it so that you could wear it that way.
Yes. And it was we still have it, and it's the greatest running, device ever. I mean, it's tiny. It has an FM radio built into it. You can store all your stuff on it. It's got a touch screen. It's great. And what they did, if you look, is like that was out for like a year, and then all of a sudden they made the iPod Nano like bigger and longer, mm-hmm. which made it actually like a
less
crappier
for that purpose.
Right, a crappier product for running, you know. And so they had to have done that for a reason, I think. So. But the health stuff, I mean, I think it'll be cool, but, you know, doesn't it? I mean, I saw speculation that they were going to try to get insurance companies to help subsidize the cost. And but doesn't that make your tinfoil hat tingle a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, like, do you want to send all this information back to Apple, you mean, or to your insurance company?
To anybody. Yeah. I mean, like,
well,
you
I
know.
Mean, well, frankly, I mean, I do. I mean, like, I've had Fitbits. I now have the Garmin Vivo Fit or whatever. And that stuff syncs up to the cloud so that your history is there and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, I do.
You're right. I mean, I've used some of that stuff too. And I guess I don't worry too much about it. But I mean, when you think about it, it's like
the Runkeeper app to, like, when I go walking or whatever, it freaking posts a GPS track of where I walked.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean,
I did that this afternoon. If you go to my Twitter feed right now, you can click on a link and see exactly where I walked this afternoon.
Yeah. I mean, and I guess it, you know, like if you go down that road of starting to be paranoid, I mean, look, I mean, they're talking about home automation too, mm-hmm. you know, as an application. And, you know, I mean, like, you know, are they going to be able to control your thermostat and, you know,
no,
and,
that's Google with the Nest
and, and, open my door. Like if they have, supposedly they're working on integration with lock companies and
I've actually been eyeing those up. I've seen those in the hardware store already. You can get the Bluetooth enabled lock with the iPhone app that goes with it. So to replace your deadbolt on your house or whatever.
Oh no, I actually really want one. But,
yeah, I want one too.
But it does make me wonder a little bit, you know.
Well, this ties into, I don't know if you listened last week when Bruce and I were talking about the self-driving cars and Google's model of that, which is all, it's not an autonomous self-driving car, it's all connected to the network, and that's how it works. And so you've got the trade-off there that on the one hand, yeah, okay, in order for this to work, Google basically has to know everything. They have to know everything about how the streets are laid out, where the lights are, where the signs are, and they have to know where everybody's driving all the time. But in exchange, you get your self-driving car.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think this is the fundamental exchange of modern life. And we're seeing this play out from everything from, you know, the NSA Snowden stuff to what Google is doing, to what Apple is doing, to what, frankly, every online company in the universe is doing in terms of how they are monetizing information about you, whether it be because they can get better advertisements in front of you, or whether they can predict what you're going to want next and try to get it to you, or whatever. But this is the exchange that, like, over the last 10, 15 years, the direction things have been going in is instead of people sort of paying up front directly for product X, they are getting a subsidized version of Product X in exchange for signing over major parts of their life.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you know what? I'll bet when this watch comes out, you know, if you got one for Alex, you know, it would tell you where he is.
Well, you know, as I was coming upstairs to here, you know, returning to our original topic, my wife was indeed searching the internet for kid GPS devices that we can attach to him to get his location. And you know, we already did this just with our iPhones. I mean, for years now, I mean, all of the, you know, myself, my wife, and my daughter have had iPhones for several years now, since the iPhone 3G or whatever it was when we first got ours. We didn't get the first iPhone. But it's had a location tracking feature, you know, first through the phone company and later through the thing. So, you know,
do you use it?
Oh yeah. So I have the Find Our Friends app where all three of us are on it. Multiple times a day, I open the thing up to see where the whole family is and see, oh, okay, you know, right now my wife's at home, I'm at work. Right now, this very second, I can see that my daughter is, you know, 20 miles south of here I can see where she is, you know, and we do use it on a regular basis.
So now this is sort of a controversial thing for us because, like, basically when we first gave my son an iPhone, I wanted to make a precondition of him getting the iPhone that I would turn on this application.
Yep.
So that I would know his location. And my wife overruled me and said that she thought it was creepy.
So here's the thing on this. The one that was through the phone company can't be turned off. With the Find My Friends, you know, she actually could turn it off. She could from her phone without our permission turn it off and hide herself from us. again, we could still do it through the phone company, but that's a different thing that you have to pay separately for. And, you know, the other thing is it's reciprocal. She knows where we are, too.
Right.
You know, it's not presented as a, you know, we're spying on you, although we are, sort of. It's more a, hey, this is just so, you know, everybody knows where we are and we're not going to get worried and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and we just, I don't think there have been other things. Like when she was younger, we had some various things on her computer monitoring. Like, you know, I would have a thing that would, at a random interval, once every, I forget, 15 minutes or something, take a snapshot of whatever was on her screen. So we actually put no restrictions on her in terms of what she could actually do. We didn't turn off applications. We didn't have restrictions on web surfing. We didn't have anything, but we got periodic screenshots.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
And I don't know if I'll do that again with Alex. Maybe, maybe not. I think it kind of worked to some degree, but it fundamentally is sort of a little bit of a violation of privacy and trust, and I think you've got sort of, it's different for a 10-year-old versus a 12-year-old versus a 16-year-old versus an 18-year-old. There's very different things going on at those ages, but it's a delicate negotiation, but I think one of the things was, we were always fairly open about whatever was going on. So we wouldn't, you know, sort of spy without knowledge. You know, it's like, you know, okay, we have the location tracking thing on. It wasn't a secret or anything. And, you know, we've got the location tracking app. All of us are on it. We can all see whatever. I think we turned off all of the, you know, screenshot and all of those restrictions. When she was 16, they were all gone. You know, because we decided it, like, once she had the iPhone, it actually became somewhat pointless because we couldn't do all of that level of detailed monitoring on the phone. And so whatever restrictions we had on the computer really didn't matter because she could do whatever she wanted on the phone.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, you know, at some point, you know, you got to just trust and, you know, you talk to them and you whatever. And, you know, the all the restrictions in the world you can come up with, they can get around anyway. Like we also for a while tried to put on restrictions of like, you know, bedtime restrictions. So the computer would shut itself off at 11 p.m. or whatever, or, you know, it would work for a certain number of hours. And then to get more hours, she would have to do chores or something or finish her homework or whatever. But all of those things were fairly easily bypassed. And I think part of that is, at least on the Mac 4 or 5 years ago, the parental control stuff was really crap. It was really not very good. And so it was buggy. There were ways around it, blah, blah, blah. But more to the point, you know, a smart teenager can figure things out. And no matter what you put in front of them, you know, they'll get around it. You know, so you can do some of that to a degree. But for the most part, it's like, you know, show them try to teach them the right things to do. And then at a certain point, you have to just say, okay, it's up to them. If they do something stupid, well, you know, that's how you learn. You do stupid things and you learn from it.
Exactly.
Which that's again, gets back to our original topic, full circle.
That's right. That's what's worked for me.
So anything else to point out about Apple or anything else we've talked about before we wrap it up? We've been going a while, so.
No, it was great to talk to you.
Yep. Thank you. And, you know, toss an email this way, more often than, on not just stuff about the show, but like what's going on and things.
I sure will.
So thank everybody. You know, thank you everybody for listening once again. I'm Sam Minter. Contact me, abelsmay@abelsmay.com for any questions, comments about the show. I'm also on Twitter @abelsmay. John, do you want to give any contact stuff or no? Yes.
Well, let's see.
Or they can just contact me and I'll pass it along.
Yeah, that. Yeah, if you want to send Sam all your hate mail about the crazy bike guy that doesn't like bicycle helmets, go for it.
There you go. I'll happily pass anything along to John. We'll see. Hopefully Yvonne will be back next week. His whole house was like destroyed. So, you know, he's dealing with that. But hopefully he'll be back before too long. In the meantime, everybody, have a great week, and we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.